This is a podcast from the Rhodes Trust, which was recorded live at the 110th Rhodes Anniversary in Oxford. In this edition, Professor Clayton Christensen, Professor C. Raj Kumar, Dr. Max Price and Dacia Toll discuss the future of education.
My name is Max Price. I'm the Vice Chancellor of the University of Cape Town, a Rhodes Scholar from came up in 1980, and I've been invited and have the pleasure to convene this session. It's only an hour, and that presents a huge problem for conveners because we have four speakers, and the topic, very generally, is education. But as you may know from the biographies in the program, one of our speakers specializes in K-12 education, a couple of us in university education, some in online learning, others in face-to-face. So we're going to raise a whole lot of issues, and I suspect many more questions than answers. The plan is that we will each speak for about 10 minutes. I'll try to keep everyone to that time, and then we'll have 20 minutes at the end for audience question answers and further discussion. It should be a really interesting session. We thought we would structure it around two questions, and the one is, what is the most most disruptive, new but productive technology technologies that are having an impact on education in the recent past and going into the short-term future? And the second is around issues of public-private interventions in the education sector. What is the role of each? And as you'll know, we span developing and developed countries. We each respond rather differently to these sets of questions. I'm not going to read the CVs of our speakers because they're again in your program, but the first up is going to be Clayton Christensen, who was at Queen's College 1975 from Utah, and is now the Kim Clark Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. He was asked to join this panel because he's published, amongst many other things, two books, one called The Innovative University, and another, which is obviously about higher education, and another called Disrupting Class, which is about K-12 education. So a really extremely well-prepared, a world expert to kick us off on the topic. Okay.
Glad to be with you. I thought I would describe some of my worst fears about higher education, and then maybe a thought or two about what do we do about it. Much of my work at the Harvard Business School has been focused on this phenomenon that companies which at one point are widely regarded as unassailably successful, a decade or two later you see them in the middle of the pack or often at the bottom of the heap. And it turns out that what causes successful companies to fail actually has a common causality to it, and that is somebody comes at the bottom of the market and kills you by going up. So let me describe how that works in the context of automobiles and then try to look at higher education and to describe why I am so concerned. So before the 1960s, in America, almost all of the cars were made by companies in America, and the same was true for Europe. And I'll just pick on General Motors as a prototype example. But they had tiers in their market. At the bottom, they sold subcompacts, and then there were compacts and mid-size and full-size and SUVs and minivans and so on. And as a general rule, the small cars at the bottom had much lower gross margins than the ones at the top. So Toyota, if you remember, came into the United States in the 1960s, and they didn't come in with Lexuses. They came in with a rusty little subcompact called the Corona. And they made it so affordable that the low end of humanity, college students, could now own a car. And so they came in right at the bottom, and General Motors had to decide, I wonder if we should invest to defend the subcompact market. The other option is to get out of the subcompact business and focus our investments in making bigger SUVs and bigger, you know. And they looked at the margins, and it made no sense to defend the least profitable part of their business. And so they got out of subcompacts, and as they got out and added up the remaining numbers, my gosh, General Motors' profitability improved by getting out of the lowest profit part of the business. And then Toyota looked at General Mills, or General Motors, they had gotten out, and all of a sudden Toyota realizes, gosh, if we could just move up into compact cars, our profits would be so much better. And so they'd move up, and then General Motors would look down at the compacts and say, you know, it just doesn't make sense to defend that because those are the least profitable parts of our business. And so they got out of that to focus on even bigger SUVs and so on. And so step by step, Toyota went from Coronas to Corollas to Camrys, Avalon, 4Runner, Sequoia, and then the Lexus. And General Motors and Ford, not because they were stupid, but because they were smart, they got out of the same products that Toyota got into. And what caused General Motors to flee up market was the pursuit of profit. And what caused Toyota to move up market was the pursuit of profit. Who's doing this now to Toyota? Kia and Hyundai, the Koreans, have come in at the bottom of the market, and they've really driven Toyota out of the low-end part of the business, not because Toyota's asleep at the switch, but why does it make any sense for Toyota to defend the least profitable part of the business when they can compete against Mercedes, where the margins are attractive? And if we had time, we could spend hours about how this has happened in industry after industry. Never happened in higher education. And we figured out why that was. There's a class of businesses that in most industries, when you go up market, there's a technological core that works at the bottom, and then you can take this disruptive business model up market. But there are a few businesses where you can't, there's no technological core. If you want to go up market, you have to emulate the people that you're trying to compete against. And that's been the case in higher education. There has not been a technological core. And so if a local university wants to become an internationally renowned research university, they have to emulate what the best does. They can't disrupt them per se. But now online learning has changed it. And online learning brings a technological core. And so a university can start at the bottom in their equivalent of subcompacts. And it's not very good. But that technological core enables them to take that business model up market step by step. And so in the past, disruption never happened in higher education, but now it very much is, we're in the middle of it as we speak. And just one other thought about what do we do about this. Generally, if the architecture of a product is interdependent, what I mean by interdependent is if you change one thing, you have to change everything. Like a rim BlackBerry is an interdependent architecture inside of it. And if they change one component, they have to change all of the other components. And when that's the architecture, you can't change anything unless you change everything. And in universities, most of us have in our curriculum, our academic curriculum, they are interdependent architectures. You can't change anything in a university unless you change everything in the university. And so if you in order to change anything, you got to change everything. You have to be a totally integrated institution. The other type of architecture we call a modular architecture, where the weight components fit together is standardized. And Dell is a modular architecture. You could call Dell up and you just say, ch-ch-ch-ch. That's exactly what I need. And what you see fairly quickly happening is the architecture of universities that are online are very quickly migrating towards modular architectures. And so there's standards by which the components fit together. And when that happens, the whole world changes. So historically, when we have interdependent architectures, the way we deliver our teaching was almost in a process business. And a process business is you get inputs, you do stuff to them, and you ship them from the other side. And so manufacturing is a process business, but education is a process business. At the Harvard Business School, we bring in 900 incomplete humans every fall, and then we do stuff to them, and at the end we ship them perfected to Wall Street. And that's inherent to the interdependent architecture that you do these things in a process. But when things become modular, then this kind of a process business evolves into what you might call a facilitated network business. And in a facilitated network business, like telecom, I send data to you, you send data to me, and you work interdependently in a network. It's not a process per se. And I bet you that what happens is most of you have read a lot about MOOCs, which are online, massive, open architecture courses. They are organized around a process-oriented architecture. And it takes a lot of money to develop a MOOC. And so you plan on everybody who use that product to use the MOOC to take the course. In a facilitated network, it's comprised almost like a soup, where you have little apps and little tutorials and little modules. And so if I want to teach this course to my student who can't spell very well, I'll get in the soup and I'll take two of these and one of those and three of these and stick it together, and I can deliver to that student a customized delivery of something that meets exactly the way his brain works and what he brought to the enterprise and how fast he wants to get out and what he wants to do with it. And I bet you that 10 years down the road, what we'll see is that the universities that have done the best in the translation to online are not the ones that make the MOOCs. Because what will happen there is there will be so much material to teach that it's very hard to differentiate yourself. But rather, what we want to do is to become the the enterprise that facilitates the network. And anybody's material can go in, but as the facilitator network, we figure out how to customize the offerings so that every student gets what they need. And that'll be a very different university than what we have now. But I think it will be much better as a result of it. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Clay. You can see with each speaker it's going to be harder and harder because they are so interesting. Desha Tull is going to be our next speaker. She came up to Mansfield in 1994. She's the co-CEO and president of an organization called Achievement First, which runs and founds public charter schools. And she's going to talk to us about some of the new innovation and disruption in that sector.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As a former middle school principal, this is exactly, no, I do not need a microphone. So I was not intimidated by that. And thanks to Professor Christensen, one of the greatest compliments I receive these days is that I am a disruptor. So that's what we're trying to do. Could I get a sense for how many Americans are in the room? Okay, that helps me prioritize my disruptions for you. Because I assume then there's some background with what a public charter school is, and we're growing in New York City, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. But so there's three trends. I'm the sort of primary and secondary representative up here on the panel. So three trends which I think do overlap with what's happening in higher education. The first, if the international folks forgive me, is U.S. specific, which is we are experiencing over the course of the next several years a significant upgrade in our standards for what we expect of students. That what's happened to the United States over the last 30 to 50 years is while our university quality remains highly respected globally, our K-12 quality has stood still while the rest of the world has improved and improved dramatically. And so you see it on international comparisons, whether it's the PISA test or other measures where the United States is now 24th, 27th, 28th, depending on whether you're looking at math, science, or English. And so finally, based on these international comparisons and based on the fact that we are sending so many students off to colleges ill-prepared, as part of Race to the Top, there's been a huge effort to upgrade standards around what's now called Common Core, the Common Core state standards. It's really national standards, but we're not allowed to talk about national standards in the United States for a whole set of political reasons. So what's happening now, and I do think it's worth pausing on this for a minute because it's going to be an earthquake when it hits in 2 years in the United States, which is there now are these much more rigorous internationally benchmark standards that require far deeper understanding of math, students to read far more complex text and have to respond to far more rigorous questions. And New York State went early and implemented these standards, and proficiency rates across the state dropped by 30 to 40 percentage points. In Rochester, New York, 5% of students are proficient in math reading. Statewide, in a state that's towards the top of the heap in the United States, 31% of students are now being judged at grade level. So I think this disruption, when it hits, is going to have a lot of both political and practical implications for schools in the United States. But moving on to those that I think trends are far broader than just that. The two I want to talk about are digital learning and blended learning and what they look like in the K-12 space, and then changes in governance and the proliferation of all these different types and kinds of public schools. So on blended learning, I would say 5 years ago, if I'd stood before you, I would have not quite poo-pooed it, but said that the hype about it was overrated. I think having watched what's come on the market, even in the last 12 months, I am far more excited about the potential to transform learning. And so just to describe to you, to give an example of the approach that Professor Christensen was talking about, there's an organization now called School of One, New Classrooms. And what happens is kids show up and you have an entire grade of sixth graders. And they look up on a computer screen and it tells them exactly where they need to go. And they go to not just what they need to learn, but the best way for them to learn. So there is an algorithm that assessed that child the night before and has been constantly learning about that student over the course of weeks and months. And that algorithm figures out what does the child know and what do they not know, and in essence, what do they need to learn next. And it figures out in what modality does that student best learn. Is it online learning? Is it one-on-one tutoring? Is it small group instruction? Is it project-based? Is it more verbal or is it more kinesthetic? And learns so much about that child and then sends groups and regroups kids in the course of a 90-minute math class at least twice based on, and then the kid, this child is assessed again. And that is the and then the content available through that portal, and I thought the point was very well taken, that content is now democratizing, and there will be a tremendous amount, I think, of increasingly good content. And where the real art and science will remain is in how to figure out the learner and match learner with content. But just to get specific, why I'm a little more bullish on blended learning, and then to be transparent about the concerns I still have about it. What it allows is there are three big enablers that it does. The first is extending learning time. And you have the anywhere, anytime learning that instead of being confined to our 6 hour and 15 minute school day, which is inadequate, honestly, for the task at hand, particularly with the new Common Core standards, we can now have students learning outside of that time, evenings and weekends, without having the constant negotiations about our teachers willing to work longer hours. Students can continue that learning in a very meaningful way. The second is that it can be really truly individualized, and that students can control their own path and pace of learning. And at the algorithmic level, we can learn a lot more about them and pitch to that. And that therefore can be very competency-based. We won't have students sitting in the standard classroom getting the same lecture from the same person if in fact they already know that content. And I think one of the ways, part of why I've gotten more bullish on it, is the third thing I think it really adds, which is truly teacher effectiveness. And I think when this originally came out, it was set up as either you're for great teachers or you're for computers, right? And God forbid the computer replace the teacher. And in fact, what it really is about increasing teacher effectiveness. And I think when I think about the job we're asking our teachers to do, it's a darn near impossible job, right? They have a class of 25 students, all of which know different things, all of which learn in different ways. And our requirements around differentiation and checking for understanding of individual students, I mean, it is extraordinary to watch a good teacher keep all the balls in the air. And imagine if they really had this powerful tool that could help them understand who needed help in what. And even Saul Khan, who you all may have heard of, Khan Academy, which is another, I think, very exciting nonprofit free revolution that's now got millions of users around the world. Even he says, I think a kid should be on a computer 2 hours a day. So we're not talking about a world in which every child is learning everything online. We're talking about a world in which, for the content that it makes sense to learn, for the students for whom it makes sense to learn online, let's do that. And then let's enable and empower the rest of the content and the rest of the time to be used in a far more exciting way. So if students are struggling with the online learning with respect to certain content, that's when they have, a lot of schools have now developed tutoring bars or where you just pick your computer right up and you go right to the teacher who's helping you, or vice versa. And then we are actually doing more group projects. I see project-based learning, ironically, making a return at the same time that blended learning kicks back up, because we can now rely on the computers to do some of the work for us. I think the differentiator that we're going to start to see that does concern me is the gap between the motivated and the unmotivated student will widen. Because clearly, and you can even see it right now in talking to Saul Khan about use of Khan Academy, he's disproportionately got more affluent parents using it with their students. And so trying to figure out how to not have this magnify many of the inequalities we're already worried about. So then just quickly on the second disruption, which is governance. In the United States, it's coming primarily through charter schools, but there are other tools in other countries where it used to be that we believed public education was defined by the government delivering the education. And there's been a real paradigm shift in the last 15 years to public education is defined as schools that serve the public and are publicly accountable, but can actually be operated by a whole set of a sort of diverse provider or portfolio model, which is where we specifically have come in. And it's overwhelmingly nonprofit, but there even are for-profit providers. And I personally, I think it's wildly exciting in terms of the number of differences of parent choice that are now available, and at that level, student choice, and the far greater accountability and dynamism that can be introduced into it. I do think Similarly, there is the concern about, do you divide the motivated and the unmotivated in a system like that? And perhaps during the Q&A we can get into a little bit more. I think there are ways to safeguard against that in both situations. Thank you.
Thank you, Desha. Third up is Raj Kumar, who, as you can see on the screen, came up to university in 1998. He is the founding vice chancellor of a very new university founded in 2009 in India, the O.P. Jindal Global University in Sonipat, Haryana. He's also the dean of the Jindal Global Law School. And this is a, linking to just the last comments on governance that Desha mentioned, this is a private but not-for-profit university established through a founding gift of a philanthropist.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here back again. The theme of this session is titled quite ambitiously as the future of education. And while we are reflecting upon some of the critical issues of education, what I hope to do in the next, say, 10 minutes is to look at the larger picture itself, particularly from the developing world and looking at reflecting on India and China and also other parts of the developing world. It is fair to say that today the entire context of higher education and education in general has been accepted around the world as one of the biggest possibilities for leading to significant social and economic empowerment. That was not the case several decades back, but that is a realization which has come about. If you look at the income, the amount of expenditure of the families that is spent on education, it reflects the importance that they've given to education, and that is clearly the case across the developing world. It is also fair to say that education is no longer something which is going to be offered in brick-and-mortar buildings like where we are. Two of our previous speakers reflected upon the growing development of online education, and increasingly some of the biggest accessibility challenges are going to be met by the expansion and what one of the speakers called democratization of education. However, I would like to still believe that there are some critical notions of pedagogy as well as inspiration that will continue to be evolved in classroom settings as opposed to online spaces, and I'm not yet convinced that we are there as far as those aspects of final learning are concerned. So thirdly, I will mention that the significant challenges relating to higher education in particular will, in the developing world, will continue to be the four big ones, which are quality, quantity, accessibility, and equity. And the problems of China and India will be that these four challenges will have to be met simultaneously. And so that's almost like impossible, but that's the task which is, these countries have accepted and is attempting to address. And a related part of that is also the historical challenge which universities around the world have attempted to address, which is to what extent they should focus on teaching as opposed to research, whether they should be creating knowledge, creating institutions on the one hand, and to what extent classroom as an avenue and important space for education should be promoted. This is the two big challenges which the developing countries are right now facing. I will briefly mention the quality and quantity issue. At least in the context of India, I can say that every now and then, every year, increasingly for the last 4 years, the international rankings of universities have come to sharper focus in the Asian context and definitely in the Indian context. And just last week, one of the international rankings, the QS World University Rankings, was released. And early October, the Times Higher Education University Rankings will be released. And every year, we are told that not a single Indian university is in one of the top 200 in the world. And while there has been a steady increase in the number of universities across the Asian region, clearly, of course, the universities in the West, in particular US and UK and Europe and Australia and New Zealand, occupy significant spaces in those rankings. I mentioned the issue of rankings because of the fact that the issue of quality in higher education has become a sharper focus in both China and India in recent times. While Unfortunately, in the Indian context, even after over 60 years of growth and development of higher education, even with over 650 universities and over 40,000 colleges, we have not been able to address the issue of quality. However, I must say that the extraordinary development that has happened in the Southeast Asian region, including South Korea, Taipei, Singapore, Hong Kong, as well as mainland China in the last two decades, has dramatically transformed the higher education sector in these countries. And steadily, you see a significant number of universities coming up from these countries in the top 200, including in mainland China. The gross enrollment ratio, which is an important way of assessing to what extent accessibility to education has been provided, India continues to hover around 16% to 17%, and China has reached over 28%. And there is a strong impetus on increasing and making education available. But even in this, India is not doing great. I will also briefly mention that one of the ways by which this challenge is being attempted to address is the fact that we don't have enough resources in India. We don't have enough possibilities of creating public institutions and expanding that. So one option or one opportunity out there is that we need to promote the need for private universities. Our own university was created with that vision. And today, the significant number of Indian higher education actually lies in the private sector and not in the public sector. Unfortunately, when India opened up the need for promoting private sector education, it did not result in the creation of the great private universities such as Harvard, Stanford, Yale, and MIT, and NYU, but we ended up creating a large number of mediocre, profit-making, commercial, at times hugely dubious institutions in the private context. That led to a certain degree of pejorativeness associated with the private sector education, and because of which we have not been able to move forward. So we are in a situation, at least in the Indian context, that a large number of public institutions which have hitherto had some reputation but are continuing to face significant challenges. I'll just give you one statistics. There are 42 central universities in the country. These are well-funded, highly reputed, historically well-known universities such as JNU, Jawaharlal Nehru University, and Delhi University. And most recent statistics show that nearly 40% of sanctioned faculty positions are lying unfilled in these leading central universities of the country. If you look at IITs and IIMs, which you're all familiar with, the leading institutions in engineering and management, nearly 35% of sanctioned faculty positions are right now lying vacant. In fact, the problem is so serious that no less than the President of India had to convene a meeting 6 months back to get the Ministry of Human Resources Development, as well as the vice chancellors of some of these universities, to get their act together to fill up these positions. Clearly, this reform is not going to emerge out of the public universities. On the other hand, the private universities have not been positive and encouraging. Most of them, I mentioned earlier, that they are not able to fulfill this challenge of maintaining a non-profit framework within the context of governance. Most people who are engaged in all kinds of businesses in the past have come into education with a view to making profit and unfortunately have little vision in terms of institution building. So the question, which is very important for both India and China, is that to what extent accountability and responsibility needs to be infused in the context of higher education reform, and how this is going to be, what ought to be the role of the government in this. So the first point which I would like to close is that accountability and responsibility is critical for any effort to reform the higher education sector, both public and private. Secondly, there needs to be a dramatic transformation as far as regulatory reforms are concerned. Unfortunately, the Indian regulatory bodies are extremely complex, highly bureaucratic, and mostly corrupt institutions, and that does not promote innovation, let alone help in institution building. Every aspect of one's institution building needs to be secured, all kinds of permission from multiple levels of government, state government, central government, ministries, regulatory bodies, and individual subject regulatory bodies. Even starting of a particular course within a school needs to be obtained, permission needs to be obtained from the government. And there are constant efforts to seek inspections of institutions with a view to ensure some sort of accountability. And in the context of the fact that there is a high levels of corruption already prevailing in the society, these opportunities of inspection and regulatory intervention provides huge opportunities for massive institutionalized form of corruption that takes place at all levels of governance. Lastly, I would say that we need to promote private, non-profit education. Unfortunately, the culture of context of philanthropy doesn't exist as we understand, at least in the U.S. context. I see many Americans here. It is fair to say that the American philanthropy is exceptional even in the global context. But in the Indian context, these examples of philanthropic contributions to create institutions are still a rarity. We are one of them, but there are a few more, Azim Premji University and Shiv Nadar in more recent times. But the point which I would like to say at the end is that the context of higher education is so central to the future of institution building and nation building in developing countries such as India and China. I do believe that the Chinese have gotten these things much better right than what India has, and we have a bigger challenge to address. And if we don't address, we are already facing a situation whereby when I was going to college, the idea of going abroad for higher education after your high school didn't exist. But increasingly today, those students who complete Indian high school are looking at education overseas. And of course, the university which I graduated from, where one of our distinguished professors here, Professor Chauhan, is, it's in a very strange situation where the best of the students who don't get admission to some of the colleges in Delhi University end up going to Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Oxford, and Cambridge. And there is an irony to it, but that does not mean that the quality of education that is being offered in those places are good. It is a skewed demand-supply context in which we are functioning, and we can no longer rest on the laurels and celebrate our past. We have a real challenge to address. Thank you so much.
Wide-ranging discussion. I thought before, I just want an indication so that we don't repeat stuff that you all know. Can you just show me by raising your hands, who of you have ever enrolled in a MOOC, in a massive open online course? Okay, relatively few. And then let me say more, because I think that your two talks may have assumed a couple of things which may not be all as widely known unless people are in higher education. Because I think that where we're all on the same page is that in the last year, probably 12 months ago perhaps, the developments in online education really passed a tipping point. We've had distance learning, we've had remote learning for decades. When TV was first, and particularly videotapes became popular, everyone thought that was going to be the end of the lecture, because you could record a lecture and you could distribute the lecture on tape, and there was not going to be any reason to come to class. And initially, but as we know, that actually had very little impact on the nature of higher education or on learning. When MIT in 2002 established its Open MIT program, and then many other universities followed, Yale followed, and many others, which was to put all of their lectures on the web. They would record, as far as possible, record the lectures, often accompanied by transcriptions of the lectures, so that you could download the transcript as well. Top lecturers, we all thought, especially those of us in developing countries where in the past, our students didn't really have the option of choosing a world-class lecturer or someone who was lecturing from a brand university that might have been thought of as more desirable, more attractive than what they had locally available. We all thought that students would beat a path to these online lectures, and that they would stop coming to lectures offered at the universities. And that didn't happen. And so why is it that in the last year, there is suddenly a different view of how disruptive this technology, these online lectures, online courses, or massive open online courses may be? It's really been through two things, which is worth highlighting. One is that all of the other courses previously were asynchronous. In other words, the lecture was given, recorded, but the student could access that lecture anytime, any place. And the relationship was an isolated relationship. The student was on their own, listening to a lecture. There might have been some in a correspondence course like the Open University, the UK Open University, there would have been a relationship with a lecturer or tutors, but essentially you were not part of a class or part of a group. And the extent to which this could be made massive was fine if all you wanted was to observe the lecture or listen to it or watch it, but it didn't go really beyond that, because there was no way that a university could provide the kind of support that it would provide to a residential student for the online student. And so it really didn't have the same kind of experience at all. And there was nothing to compare. Being at a university, being in classes, being in tutorials, living and engaging with other students and tutors is such a different experience from watching a course computer screen that it's not surprising the one has not disrupted the other. What's happened in the last year or two, but especially in the last year, is that the courses have become synchronous and interactive. So the course starts on a particular day, and everyone who enrolls on it, enrolls in the MOOC, enrolls on the same week. The lectures are given, or you access the lectures at the same time, and then you are clustered into relatively small groups of students who are all enrolled in the same course. Sometimes it may be 10 students in a cluster, maybe 50, maybe 100. And a lot of the interaction, all the interaction takes place between the students. You put your assignments up on the web and other students give you feedback. If an assessment has to be marked, you only get your mark. You may be instructed to mark five other assessments and they're sent to you, five other students' work. It's sent to you. And you only get your mark, which will have been marked by five other people, when you've marked five other scripts or five other things. So what's changed is that the courses have become highly interactive. And the evidence is already showing that the quality of the feedback you get from these five others is often much better than you would traditionally have got from a postgraduate teaching assistant. And also that you're learning from reading four other people's scripts or five other people's scripts is huge because you get to see how they think about the same problem that you've been thinking about and addressing it. And in a way, you're obliged to read it if you're going to be part of this. And then, in addition to that, there can be a sort of rich version of the course where you do actually have interaction. The chat rooms, the discussion rooms are moderated by a lecturer or by a tutor or by dozens of tutors. And you may even get feedback from a tutor at appropriate times. The other thing that's changed is it's become possible to identify who's on the other side of the computer. So one of the problems of the historic online learning was that if it was really just for yourself, but there was no way of verifying and validating who was doing the course. So if you wanted to do it for marks or get a credit, well, you could get someone else who'd done the course before to come and write the assignment or to sit the exam online, and there would be no way of verifying that. Today, the data analytics is very sophisticated. So it turns out that your typing style is like a fingerprint, and that the real-time monitoring of your keystrokes is as accurate an identifier of who's on the computer as your iris or your fingerprint. And the webcams also will take pictures of your iris and will verify who you are and who's on the computer. So the possibility of ensuring that the person who's enrolled is actually the person or writing the exam or writing the test or submitting the assignment is actually the same person has changed. And so universities are now looking at the possibility of giving credits, which they weren't doing before. They were just making it available. But now the possibility of giving credits for these courses. So this interactivity and the possibility of identifying and the possibility of giving credits is really what's changed the game. And why everyone is sitting up and saying, how is this going to affect us now? Just as an aside, talking about the data analytics, it turns out that, as Clay was saying, people have very different learning styles. And one of the things you can do through observing people online is understand their learning styles. So you understand whether they have to read a paragraph or a page three times before they get it, or whether they get it first time. If there are a series of math problems, you know how long it takes them to master something, a technology or a technique or a problem-solving solution. And it turns out that many employers are much less interested in whether you've passed a course and what your grade was than in what your learning style is. So that one of the challenges we now have to deal with is how do you protect this information, because employers are willing to pay lots of money, and in fact, although you may sign the company offering the course may say your data is protected and we won't give it out to employers, increasingly, when you go and apply for a job, the employer will say, we only give you this job if you give us access to your data analytics from the courses you've done. If you want the job, you give us access. And based on that, they'll make a whole lot of decisions about whether to offer you the job. So these are why we're talking about disruptions in higher education. It is potentially game-changing. Now, I have to say the jury is out. There are, if you read the literature, you'll see that half of the people are skeptic and say it's just another fad, as were the previous mass education opportunities. The other half, and I would say the majority, are saying it may be a fad, but we can't afford to be left behind. And so massive amounts of money is being invested. If you go onto the Coursera website, which is one of the companies that is offering the MOOCs, you'll find that about 40 of the best US universities and another 40 from around the world are signed up with Coursera, offering MOOCs and courses, and some of them offering them for credit. So coming back to the perspective of, for example, a vice chancellor in a developing country, this makes for anxious times, because when we enroll a student, and we charge per course, for example. And if a student were to go to MIT or to Harvard and take Maths 1 there on a semester study abroad program, we would typically have given them a credit because we think it's a reasonably good quality course and it's probably as good as the Maths 1 course we offer. And so we'll give them a credit for that on their way to getting a physics degree or an astronomy degree or a computer science degree. If they can get that same credit online, and if they can get a dozen other credits online, then they're going to come to us and say, we've already taken these 10 courses. We did them while we were at school. We've done them in our gap year. We want credits for these, and there's no reason why we shouldn't give it, because it would be hypocritical to say you can go and study there, but you can't get the credit. And so we would now have students coming and getting a degree from our universities for which they'd perhaps taken less than half the courses at our university. And the whole residential experience would have been very different. And the question would be also financially the problem of offering degrees for which students are paying half as much. And then we would have to say, well, they could. Curtin University in Australia and now offers a degree, I understand. Is anyone here from Curtin University before I malign them? No. Curtin University offers a course where you can collect all your credits from other universities bar one. You have to take a capstone course from Curtin to get a Curtin degree. But that changes the nature of higher education and university experience. And the question we then have to ask is, what are we really adding as a residential experience that is beyond the content, beyond the sum of the courses which you might enroll for? And can we put a value on that? And can we put a price on that so that we can actually say this is worth paying for? It's a new meaning to the globalization of higher education. We've often talked about globalization. Historically, when we talked about the globalization, we meant students' mobility, going on semester abroad. We meant having lecturers from other countries. We meant incorporating in the curriculum aspects of how we would prepare students to be global citizens, to work in companies that had branches all over the world. Now what we mean is that there is no longer a geographical advantage to your seat, to your base. You are competing in a way that we'd never imagined before, with universities from all over the world, with very strong brands, with very high quality courses, with experiences which are interactive and which students rate very highly, and on top of all of that is cheaper than almost anything that we can offer in a residential format. So I suggest to you that these really are disruptive technologies, and that the world of higher education is in the most exciting place it's been for decades. So I'm going to pause there. There's lots more we could say, but I think we won't have time for audience Q&A. So let me pause there and open it to the floor. Okay, I'm going to take four hands first. 1, 2, 3, and 4. I hope I'll remember. You go first, yeah.
Thank you. That was so fascinating. I've been working in secondary education since I left Oxford about 12 years ago. And meaning middle school and high school. And what drew me to it was not just the sort of fundamental purpose about knowledge and skills and individual students, but the sort of social purpose of education. You know, at least in the United States, we've traditionally understood that schools have a civic purpose, that they're essential to democracy, that they're a feature of strong communities. And I would just love to hear some of you speak to whether some of these disruptive trends might be disrupting that feature of schools. To what extent might they enhance the civic purpose of schools or undermine it?
Fabulous question. Okay. I'm going to take three questions,
okay.
But if you'd just note that, because in particular, we're not all going to be able to answer all the questions, so we'll try to pass them out. Yeah.
I wanted to take the other side of the frame you offered in the beginning and say then, what is going to stay the same? What aspect of education is so fundamental and has become, as a model, so successful that not only has it endured, but it will continue to endure and disrupt this disruption. The disruption buck will stop somewhere and something will be left, and I'm curious what you think that will be.
Thank you very much. Claire, I think I'm going to let you take that question. Yes.
I'm also lucky to work in secondary education at a school called Athenian in California, founded by a Rhodes Scholar. And when we talk about what type of students we want to produce, what keeps coming up to us is we want students who are passionate about what they do. And the challenge we face is, how do you teach passion aside from just getting kids excited? Are there things that we can do as adults, aside from just independent studies, to get kids to find their passions?
Great. I think that's similar, not unlike the first one. So I'm going to leave that with you, Dasha. Okay, so I've forgotten. There we go. Yeah, thank you.
Could you talk about the increasing financial burden that the students in the United States are under and the financial pressures that have been shifted to the government on financing, and at some point in time there is a bubble in higher education that's going to affect either the institutions or the students?
Okay, I suspect that's quite a US-specific thing, so I'll ask you to do that, Clay. Can I see if there's a hand for a question that relates more to the India, China, and developing country side of things? Sir, at the back, yeah.
I'm not sure. Do you anticipate sort of the capital cost would be for increasing online education in a country like India? In terms of, or would you be better placed, because you have to include not just the cost of establishing, but also the power sources required to generate the power to be able to use it. Would you be better placed to sort of spend more money on developing teachers and numbers of teachers and so on?
Okay, we'll see if we have anyone answer. Last question, sir.
A lot of the talk around online education has been about the pedagogical impact. But what I'd like to ask in the context of developing countries, what sort of disruption do you think it might have in terms of capacity? And what I mean by that is what Raj said, is that there's this great challenge to provide both quantity, quality, and equity in education. And I wonder if online education will perhaps be able to solve capacity issues in developing countries. I look at South Africa and I wonder if some of the issues are not just pedagogical, it's the capacity of having the number of teachers.
Okay, right. I think we'll be able to pick that up. So let's start with Clay, if you'll you want to start?
Sure. So I have two great questions. The first one is from you. What needs to stay the same? Actually, not much. When you look at online learning, does it at a better cost, more effectively? The networks and friends that you can get, there's increasing evidence that the next generation are very comfortable creating their networks online, you know? Let me tell you what I worry about from the Harvard Business School that needs to stay the same. So I went up to Maine. There's a really lovely university there that asked me to talk about the future. And I gave my normal gloom and doom scenario for them. Then we had dinner, and it was the trustees of the university. And I was sitting next to the president, and in a discreet way over dinner, he pointed to this woman and said, she just gave us $44 million. And her link was not
some novel that she read as a senior. But it was an English literature professor that changed her life. And then he said, see that guy, he gave us $18 million. And his link is not an equation, he studied math. It was the hockey coach who changed his life. And she went through, and everybody who was generous to the university, the link was to a professor who changed their life. And I've thought a lot about this, because then I go back to the Harvard Business School. I attend all of the reunions, and I listen to what do our graduates talk about as they banter back and forth. And very often, it was a professor who changed their lives. The problem is, at Harvard, I love my colleagues, but there are only about 10 or 12 names of professors who consistently are remembered as having changed their lives. And when we recruit new college or professors, we look at how do they do their research. Occasionally, are they good teachers? Never do we ask the question, is this the kind of person who has chosen this field because she wants to change the lives of students? And that's the thing that I don't think the online medium can change. And yet, our universities certainly aren't investing what has to be the core of who we are. It's everything else, online learning can beat us at that game. So I worry about that. The cost is just horrific. And never have we had competition on prices. Always we compete to offer better and more expensive. And then the government puts a floor on pricing by giving them grants and access to student loans. And I don't know what America's going to do, because I think maybe half of our universities will be bankrupt in 15 years, and the government will have no solution to the problem. So we need to pray for ourselves.
From prayer to passion. So I think it might be most helpful to respond with a specific example. There's a group of schools in California that I found quite inspiring called Summit Public Schools. And they basically have said, along the lines of the question, there are four things we're trying to develop in students. And to me, they captured it pretty well. The first is content knowledge, and that there is a body of knowledge that we still expect students to master, including maths writing and reading, but also science and history and many other wonderful things. Then we expect them to have certain cognitive skills, problem solving, maybe you could put writing more in that sort of more transferable category. Then we expect them to have certain habits of success, which are sometimes called non-cognitive skills, but interpersonal skills, perseverance, passion, and then we want them to have had certain experiences or real world experiences. And I think they have thought very thoughtfully about where in that constellation does digital learning fit. And what they've determined is that it fits most neatly with the content. And that, in fact, it's hugely empowering because kids can actually learn, now that the content of online learning has gotten so much better, they can actually learn faster and more efficiently in that way, in a way that actually frees up time, space, and most importantly, teacher capacity to help facilitate some of the other things. So that if you take a typical math class now, their kids are doing the content primarily through online learning, with the opportunity for tutoring, if you need tutoring, right? So you still find a real-world individual to help you if you need help. But math class now is entirely project-based, and they're trying to get at these cognitive skills, which they think can only be assessed by really hearing people think, talk, write, et cetera, and the habits of success, all the other interpersonal stuff. So again, I think the fear has been set up that we're choosing teachers or computers, we're choosing social skill, or we're choosing kind of content mastery. And I don't think we've realized how actually empowering and enabling these technologies can be if used in the right way. And just, I was so enamored by Dr. Price's sort of articulation of what's changed in the last few years that have made this a far more disruptive technology. Just to add on to his very good list, I think the other thing that's changed is while learners are different, we're actually, the cognitive science shows that human beings are more similar in how they learn than different. And what's the primary way we learn? Does anybody know? Practice, actually. It's not just your golf game or athletics, right? But that actually it's through math, it's through actually solving problems, right? And learners are different, but we're far more similar. And I think one of the big evolutions is it's not passively listening to a video anymore. In fact, Sal Khan, who has this, what was primarily a video-based instruction of him teaching all these lessons, he says the dirty little secret is nobody watches the videos. They go right now to the practice. And basically, you're learning through trying and not getting it right and iterating again and learning from that and trying it again and trying it again. Of course, it's facilitated if you can get feedback at each step. But that is, in fact, how we learn. And that is now incorporated through these online portals so that you can get lots of practice and feedback. So I continue to believe that there is actually a way to unlock more passion and more success in these habits of success areas if we allow the computer to do at least part of the job for us.
Thank you. So let me just quickly answer how to disrupt the disruption. I do think that some of the more fundamental aspects of seeking inspiration from individuals and institutions may not emerge through the online context. And although I don't predict the future as he does, but I do think that we may expect a more organic form of developments happening and not just the sort of online framework taking over. And so there will be ways by which the disruption will indeed be disrupted. And I do think that the sort of responsible citizenship as an objective of education and universities will continue to be a critical pedagogy which we will pursue. And another adverse consequence of this I also see is that what about the humanities? I mean, you know, the growth and development of focus on disciplines such as science and engineering and medicine and technology, we do feel that the focus on humanities is unfortunately lost in that process. I just quickly want to mention that, capacity will be, expanding online education can indeed respond to the capacity problem that prevails in developing countries. But I have to confess here that increasingly what is happening is that because unless and until you change the way institutions function, you are having a situation where companies and corporations are doing precisely that. So there are leading companies and corporations in the developing world which have created some sort of a university whereby these people who are recruited are actually going through a two-year learning process. What the universities have failed in doing is being done by the companies and corporations. So we cannot avoid and undermine the importance of universities to themselves change and reform. The capital costs, I mean, frankly speaking, if accessibility is a critical problem, we need to invest in it, and that will indeed help. But at the same time, that cannot substitute the importance of good teachers and good schools. Thank you.
This podcast was recorded live on Wednesday, the 18th of September, at the Medical Sciences Teaching Centre. The speakers were Professor Clayton Christensen, Utah and Queens, 1975, Professor Siraj Kumar, India and University, 1998, Dr. Max Price, South Africa at Large, 1980, and Dacia Toll, Maryland, D.C. and Mansfield, 1994. To find out more, visit www.rhodeshouse.ox.ac.uk.